Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. I think we're going to do something a little bit different today. I have to warn you that this is not going to be a safe space. There may be triggering things that you will hear. And I mention this because there are a lot of folks out there who seem to believe that they are entitled to never hear anything they disagree with, so that I will get, reaction. People go, well, Charlie, you lost me yesterday because you expressed this opinion, and I am never going to be listening to you again. Or why did you allow that guest to, present that particular view? Well, because people, this is what we do here. You know, if you really don't want to hear an opinion that you disagree with, maybe you should just, talk to yourself. You know, go in a room, create your own echo chamber, and then you will never confront an idea that you don't agree with. And this is something that, frankly, I have been talking about for a long time. I just think it's a very strange thing. Actually, back in the 80s and the 90s, I remember thinking how strange it was that people on university campuses would become indignant that they had heard something that offended them. And my reaction at the time was, if you really, never want to be offended, you should join like a Trappist monastery or something, or live in the woods. Just don't ever go on public transit, and don't go to a university where the whole point is that you're going to be presented with ideas that are going to make you uncomfortable. They will make you uncomfortable because, in theory, you went to the university to learn something because you were stupid. I'm sorry. That's not what I'm saying. That you had a certain level of ignorance that needed to be challenged. And anytime you challenge ignorance, it's going to be uncomfortable in any case. Our guest this weekend is Greg Lukianoff, who is the president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, the co-author, what a great title this book is, The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. Greg, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for so much for having me, Charlie.
Well, people, just a little bit about backstory here. That one of the reasons I wanted you on the podcast is you were trolling me on social media.
Positive trolling.
You pulled my chain. You actually, I don't want to misquote you here, but you basically called me out and said, Charlie, why aren't you talking more about the attacks on free speech on universities? You used to talk about this all the time. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you poked me, and I felt it. I mean,
that's not really what I said, Charlie. I said, why aren't you bragging about having been right about this in the late 80s, early 90s?
Well,
it wasn't negative. It was actually saying, dude, like I reread your stuff and I was like, you were saying this before almost anybody else.
Well, yes, I was. And it does feel like a different world. And, that's why I do appreciate this. This is true that I actually remember having lunch with some reporter. It must have been after one of my first books came out. Mm-hmm. And it was for a major national magazine. And I said, one of the things that bothers me the most are the number of universities that are actually creating speech codes, mm-hmm. Formal bans on speech. And he gave me this look like, no. I said, how many? And it was like, no, this is really happening. And so at that point, this had not really penetrated that the universities were going so far as to, write down rules of what you could say and what you couldn't say. And I mean, now that seems like old news, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of funny because there was a sort of a crop of article of books talking about the problem in higher ed starting around the mid 80s, Alan Bloom's Closing of the American Mind, your book Prof Scam, and then Hollow Men, of course, also by people like Dinesh D'Souza and Roger Kimball. Yeah. But it was, largely conservative saying that there's a problem on campus. The funny thing is now most of the people who are critics of higher ed, or at least the best known ones with a few exceptions, are more either moderate or liberal. I'm actually a Democrat. And what's funny is people keep on trying to push even that group into the realm of the unacceptable right winger. And it's like, no, the conservatives made this argument in the 80s and 90s, and you also dismissed it then. And incidentally, Charlie, all of this happened right before everything was about to get much worse. When the last speech code was defeated at my alma mater, Stanford Law School, in 1995, which, by the way, I got there in 97 and nobody breathed a word of this when I was there, because it was like a dirty little secret. The viewpoint diversity on campus plummeted in the late 90s. The number of speech codes skyrocketed. This is actually something that most people don't know, is that by the time we actually were able to really start evaluating it, we found, with kind of rigorous data, we found in 2008 something like 75 or 79% of colleges had speech codes, despite the fact they had been defeated in court from 1989 to 1995.
And I want to get to why that is, because for the last 20 or 30 years, it just blows my mind that institutions that are founded on the whole concept of teaching critical thinking and academic freedom would adopt these speech codes. But let's talk about how big the problem is. Mm-hmm. Because there is this back and forth with people saying that the university, you know, has just lost its way. You saw this with some of the folks that went to found the University of the New University of Austin. Sort of this apocalyptic view that the university has just ceased to be a place where any ideas can be spread around. And then on the other side, there are people who say there's no problem whatsoever. There's none. There's just a few scattered anecdotes and no big deal. So. Obviously, this is what you do for a living, is to document exactly how widespread this is. So how big a problem is this, and where does it come from?
Well, those are two very big questions. And to be clear, we've only moved more towards. So I'm the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. I've been doing this since 2001, so I just celebrated my 20 years doing this. And we've only recently really focused on documenting. We've only been big enough to start doing more research into our own data more recently, because our main job was actually to battle it, was to make sure that we defended the rights of student and faculty. And by the way, all over the spectrum, like there's a big middle of unsexy cases that never make it into the media that aren't all that political, that they are, you know, internal fights between administrators and students or administrators and professors, sometimes about things as, unsexy as whether or not you have a student union. And those get very little coverage. So one of the things we've been trying to do is to try to, document this a little bit better. And the reason why, I'm currently somewhat at wit's end is that we started trying to research how common it is for professors to get targeted for being fired on campus. And we published something where we showed that in 2020 alone, and 2020 was a particularly bad year. It was actually the worst year that I'd ever seen for free speech on campus. And that's saying a lot, given it's
really okay.
There were something more over 120 professors targeted for being fired. And we actually had the son of Martin Gurry, I forget his first name, wrote something that got quoted by Michelle Goldberg, someone I really like at the New York Times, by the way, Michelle Goldberg, saying that, wow, if a problem was happening at this level of frequency, we'd consider it essentially solved. And I felt this compulsion to sort of start putting these numbers in perspective. This means that there were 20 incidents like that at Stanford since 2015. There were 12 at Harvard since 2015. Again, there were 8 at Penn. There was 7 at Yale. And then, of course, you have this very big Yale case now. But the funny thing about that, Charlie, is that the case that's currently being treated like it was a really bad case at Yale, because it was a really bad case, just so listeners know, this was at the law school, and you expect law schools to be a little bit more mature about some of this stuff. But a student had written in a joke email, and this is a gay Native American student, to one of the multicultural groups about having a party, and was talking about, come to the trap house, in order to, and full disclosure, I used to have that job in law school, which is you get people together for drinks, and your whole role is to write a jokey email, and the goal is to be as funny as possible. And maybe this wasn't all that funny, but he used the term trap house. Trap house is slang for a place that sells drugs. Oh my goodness. But that got interpreted as him being racially insensitive, because even though this is slang that's pretty common among younger people, it's also used by African Americans. And they really tried, they really threw the book at him. And what's remarkable about this case is it's getting really good reporting from the Alan's, I forget to say Al's last name, Aaron Silburn at the Washington Free Beacon. But for us at FIRE, this is just another day at the office. We've seen tons of cases like this. And one more example that's also been Dorian Abbott was a professor.
This is one of the most prominent cases.
Yeah, and he's a scientist. He's an astrophysicist, I think. And he's at Chicago, but he wrote a letter. He wrote an op-ed saying that I think the current focus of diversity, equity, and inclusion is misplaced. And I think that that we should pick people according to merit. And it's not some crazy screed. It's actually a pretty reasonable critique, some of which I agree with, some of which I don't, but so what? And he got disinvited from MIT because of this outside writing. It had nothing to do with what he was going to be speaking on. Now, that's bad, of course, and people expect better of MIT. But if you look at Caltech, MIT, Virginia Tech, we've seen more than a dozen examples of professors being disinvited for things unrelated to what they were going to say at technical schools. So I think like people, the fact that people, when they find out about some of these things, are horrified. It's like, where have you been?
Yeah, where have we been over the last 20 years? So the Dorian Abbott case is very interesting because we're not talking about somebody who made a slur or said something on social media or anything like that. He wrote an article expressing an opinion about what the standards of scientific academia should be, right? He was going to give a speech that had nothing to do with that subject, was not a political talk that he was going to give at MIT.
Really cool astrophysics thing. I wish I could remember.
Right. He was going to talk on astrophysics, and yet someone objected because he had expressed this opinion. So, okay, the obvious question I have to ask you is, why is this happening now? Where does it come from? Is this all a function of, and I feel like the word's already worn out, wokeness on campus?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, is this why we're seeing this surge, because of woke academics or woke students?
As per usual, my explanation of this, has multi-steps, just like we did in Coddling the American Mind, my book with Jonathan Haidt, trying to figure out why the students hitting campus in 2014 were so different than millennials, for example. Mm-hmm. We talk about six different causal threads. We talk about the feedback loop of polarization, which we call the polarization spiral, that the right and left tend to make each other even worse in reaction to the, perceived or sometimes accurate sins of the other side. So it's one of these, when people talk about it's the right side, it's the left side, it's kind of like, well, they actually, they drive each other nuts and it makes everything more intense. But I do think that a lot of what you were seeing early on, the fact that there was relatively low viewpoint diversity among professors, even in the 80s, it was still about 2-1, 3-1, liberal to conservative back then, and that's gotten way worse. It's now I think 5-1, and that hides the fact that it's literally zero people in some of these academic departments would self describe as conservative, or certainly certainly not vote conservative. And that's a problem because it creates groupthink, it creates tribalism, it creates all these other distortions. One of the big trends that has made everything worse is the hyper-bureaucratization of universities. And that's actually even more, as Samuel Abrams, a great statistician that I get to work with sometimes, has pointed out, that that's a group that's even more ideologically monolithic, but also has a much more daily interaction with students. That is, they run the bias related incident programs, which are kind of the successors to the speech codes.
When you're talking about the bureaucracy, you're talking about the diversity bureaucracy, the diversity, inclusion, equity bureaucracy, or the whole bureaucracy?
I'm talking about the whole bureaucracy. Okay. Talking about the whole bureaucracy. We've had the most issues with people in residence life, actually, because the residence life officials, think that it really is literally their job to sort of police speech pretty often. Now, of course, to be clear, there's always people who are very good at this. Actually, I'm sure that most people are trying to do the best. But that's also, there are also plenty of examples of both RAs getting in trouble for being slightly nonconforming, but also, ratting on students to get them in trouble. And you mentioned the fact, Charlie, that, when you talked about Dorian Abbott, that this wasn't a slur. Yes, absolutely. I'm a First Amendment lawyer. I worked at the ACLU of Northern California. Like, this is my lifelong passion. And I'm willing to defend even the Nazis. In fact, we did a documentary about the life and times of Ira Glasser. I'm one of the executive producers, the old executive director of the ACLU, who defended the Nazis at Skokie. So I'm willing to defend the most extreme speech. But overwhelmingly, what I deal with on campus are oftentimes nice kids, pretty nice professors who are saying things that they have no idea how this could possibly be interpreted in an offensive way.
Give me an example of that.
Well, I mean, like the most classic example that I talk about, you know, going way back was the case where a student was reading Notre Dame versus the Klan. It's a book celebrating.
Oh, gosh, I remember that story. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one of my classic cases. And he was found guilty of racial harassment. Now, that was a long time ago. But I also think of the Trap House case as being, you know, kids just being, you know, trying to crack a joke. One of the things that's been interesting and above the law has definitely been pushing this really hard is that it used to be considered scholarly and acceptable to, if you're talking about a case, a Supreme Court case that involves racial epithets, as long as you're not using that term against the student, which would, you know, would be fireable in a lot of cases. But if you're discussing it in an academic way, you're supposed to kind of shift the way you think about it and be able to talk about these things, particularly as they're accurately reported from Supreme Court cases. And we've seen dozens of examples of professors, mostly from the left, getting in trouble for not using a slur, but actually uttering the entire word, which is a major norm shift just in the last 5 years, including, you know, like I said, a liberal professor at the New School who was making the point that the book Not My Negro, which is about James Baldwin, that it showed a lot of temerity for misquoting James Baldwin because that's not the word James Baldwin actually used. Mm-hmm. And we see, you know, we got 1,500 case submissions in 2020. So, like, it can be hard to even get through all the examples we've seen. And it's important for listeners to understand about 400 schools educate about 50% of the students in the country. This idea that there are very few, like, there's people who would like people to, like listeners to believe that there are like 100,000 schools and many millions of professors, when it's actually much more concentrated than people think.
So here's a question that I have for you that I know that you dealt with in The Coddling of the American Mind. When I first started writing about this, one of my initial takeaways was that there were people who were locked and loaded looking for things to be offended about, that a lot of the cases involved speech that actually didn't offend anyone, but that someone wanted to be offended, or they would use it as a cudgel because there were certain advantages to claiming victim status or being offended. But now I wonder whether or not it shifted from people thinking that they ought to be offended to real snowflakes who really are offended by this, that this new generation actually, when they do hear a view that they've never heard before, which is, of course, you've described, you know, the polarization that we live in. It's possible that suddenly you hear an idea that, you know, just seems, you know, completely radical to you. So, I mean, have people become more hypersensitive?
Or
is it still kind of a cynical, I'm posturing and I'm going to make a case of something. I'm not really offended, but I think somebody might be offended. So there might be somebody out there, sort of the mythical person who is offended by every single word or thought or image that they don't like.
The true answer, as it is to most things, is all of these things are happening at the same time. We see cases where they very much look cynical, where someone is just trying to get that student or professor they don't like fired. But I do think that, and one of the things we talk about in Coddling the American Mind is the incredible disservice we do to these, you know, oftentimes absolutely brilliant young students, you know, and starting in K-12, telling them that they can actually be harmed by words. And in truth, you know, the research indicates that people are really quite resilient, but you can create a self-fulfilling prophecy if you tell people that, you know, if you hear the wrong thing, it's going to damage you for life. It's incredibly irresponsible. And you can see kind of combinations of, you know, some amount of cynicism and some amount of people really feeling offended kind of existing at the same same time on campus. Oh, one phenomenon I want to point out, though, is that prior to 2013, 2014, working on campuses, it was always the administrators who were generating the problems, who were
right.
trying to punish faculty, trying to punish students. And again, sometimes it's generally mixed motives, you know, that essentially I don't like this student. And by the way, they gave me an opportunity to get this student in trouble. In 2013, more 2014, it was like lightning struck. The change among the students coming in was just profound. And it was not, like I said, it wasn't subtle. And suddenly you went from students being totally the best protectors of free speech on campus for at least all of my career, who got offensive lyrics, who got offensive jokes, who stood up for their who set up free speech walls, suddenly becoming much more activist against expression, you know, talking about new speech codes. It was the first time I saw a critical mass of students really demanding new speech codes. Of course, that happened in the 80s and the 90s, but I wasn't doing this yet. That you had, you know, people, that's when you're first hearing things like microaggressions and an increase in disinvitations and all of this kind of stuff.
That's when the triggering and the safe rooms and all the safe spaces came about. So, yep. I mean, so originally it was administrators who sort of adopted this projection of the fragility of the yes. students, but then there was the shift where it was the students who were embracing their own fragility.
Yeah. Well, and that's something we've really been trying to get to the bottom of. I mean, honestly, Coddling the American Mind, the whole thing is trying to figure out mm-hmm. what was so different about the students hitting campus around 2014. And, you know, as per usual, we came up with a whole bunch of different things. But we did, in my opinion, probably leave some things out because it was really clear, even when we wrote the original article in 2015, we wrote the book in 2018. That the students were showing up on campus already believing, you know, in the fundamental, yeah. what we call the three great untruths. What doesn't kill you makes you weaker, always trust your feelings, and life is a battle between good people and evil people, which we consider like the worst possible advice you could give to anyone, really. And I increasingly think that what happened was a kind of slower process in some ways that got sped up. And by the way, why was it all so sudden? The answer a lot of times is social media, because what social media did is it didn't necessarily always create new trends. It just sped up ones that were already existing meant that they all would land, you know, and in this case, these were the first generation of students who had social media in their pockets since they were little. Is a big part of our theory, but I also think that the a change in the nature of education schools in the 80s and 90s started having long-term effect on what kids were taught in K through 12.
Which was foreseeable. I think the other thing is...
Charlie, yeah. You foresaw it.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. Although I must admit, I didn't foresee the extent to which all of this would overflow the banks. So we're talking about the shifts. Two things really strike me about the difference between when I was first starting writing about this and now is that a lot of this, you know, used to be confined, or most of this used to be confined to university campuses. And of course, there were warnings. What if this seeps out into the rest of society? Well, it has now.
Yeah.
These attitudes have now overflowed into corporate America, where we have these, you know, various, you know, fragility workshops, et cetera. And into K-12 education, which is why, of course, this is a big flashpoint right now. The other thing that really strikes me, and I'm looking at your database here, which is really fascinating. People could look at it at thefire.org, the scholars under fire, that when I was first writing about this, most of the assaults on free speech were coming from the politically correct left.
Mm-hmm.
And now, particularly, again, this is related to the fact that it's now, you know, become much more cultural, you know, society-wide. You now see many of the attacks coming from the right. So people going to be listening to us going, okay, so we're talking about, you know, free speech on campus at the time when many of the, and again, this is part of the disorientation about free speech, because, you know, up until 5 minutes ago, most, I think, you know, prominent conservatives would have said we are defenders of academic freedom and free speech. And now they are, many of them are lined up behind literal bans on books and words in one state after another. Critical race theory is something that you and I have been talking about for many, many years, is profoundly illiberal. by redefining what is acceptable discourse, so that, you know, critical race theory itself is hostile to free speech. But the reaction to critical race theory is as crude as possible. So in the state of Wisconsin, they come up with lists of words that you can't use, specific images and books that you can't use. So we are right now, Greg, it feels like, in this midst of this pincer movement.
Yes.
From the right and the left, from the illiberal right and the illiberal left. And your targeting incidents, the website, what really struck me is you go through all the incidents, the political motivation of the attacks. And I'm just reading randomly, you know, on from 2019, from the left, from the left, from the right, from the right, from the left, from the right. It's just like, it's almost now a coin flip. Who is going to be more aggressive in trying to cancel you or shut you down? And so we are really, it feels like, in a very perilous moment.
Oh, yeah.
Where you have the assault. I mean, do you agree with that? I mean,
absolutely.
Where the support for free speech was always a little thin among the woke left. But now, and this is very sort of soul crushing for me, is also to watch how paper thin that support was, and perhaps how cynical the support was for free speech among conservatives.
Yeah, no. So we've been battling the CRT laws applied to higher ed from day one. And we've been telling everybody who will listen, these are unconstitutional as applies to higher ed. The analysis gets more legally complicated as applied to K through 12, because states actually do have a substantial authority to contribute to curriculum. But at the same time, they're creating what I call this negative curriculum. So one of the things I've been trying to do, I wrote something called The Empowering of the American Mind, trying to give a whole bunch of sort of positive principles like individuality and freedom of conscience and all these kind of things, that rather than saying don't, how about say, like, actually, we think why don't we have a positive vision of it instead? But the interesting thing about the targeting of, so the laws are bad and almost always unconstitutional as applied to higher ed. But the trend of people being, you know, targeted for canceling on the right is at least in no small part a product also of social media, because there aren't, frankly, all that many conservatives on campus to begin with, particularly among professors.
Right.
But a lot of from around 2014, once again, we started seeing professors getting in trouble from the right for what they tweeted. And then we started seeing professors getting in trouble more often for what they said in class from the right. And that has really accelerated. A lot of the examples you'll see on our database are actually ones that come from the right. But there are some meaningful distinctions here. If it comes from the left, you are somewhat more likely to actually be fired or punished. That's partially because the critiques from the right usually come from off campus. The critiques from the left usually come from on campus. But however, not to be outdone, if you're being threatened with physical violence, that is more likely to come from the right.
So you were engaged in a debate over the summer over the question of whether freedom of speech is best upheld by law or by culture.
Right.
And I think this is a fascinating question, because so far the Supreme Court has drawn a pretty solid line around free speech. The courts have been generally reliable protectors of free speech. But you talk about the danger of the shift in the culture that you're talking about. And when I describe the, you know, the overflowing the banks, I mean, we're talking about, you know, cancel culture norms spreading beyond campuses to newsrooms, corporate boardrooms. I mean, sooner or later that ends up in the courtrooms, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And this is something that I did a debate with my friend Ken White at Reason magazine about what's more important, free speech culture or free speech law. And my argument is that if I had to choose between the two, it would be profound commitment to free speech culture. The best is both worlds, which I think we were, you know, somewhat took for granted that I grew up for example, in the 80s and 90s at a time when the appreciation for free speech culturally was very strong, and the law was actually good and getting better. And I think that's the ideal circumstance. But I think we kid ourselves when we think that, and nobody really thinks this, but sometimes you do get the impression that people think that law is sort of handed down by heaven as opposed to a product of existing cultural norms. Mm-hmm. You know, the First Amendment came out of an appreciation for free speech culture, for the norms of freedom of speech, of things that we used to express in idioms. idioms that were very common when we were kids. Like, of course, it's a free country. Everyone's entitled to their opinion. You know, for that matter, walk a mile in a man's shoes. All of these, or also none of your business. You know, these were all things that were much more commonly said when we were younger that have largely kind of fallen out of favor and to some degree, troublingly, have been replaced with ideas like speech is violence or can be violence, which is, of course, rediscovering the norms of the 13th century rather than of the 24th.
Okay, this was a point I wanted to get to because this strikes me as one of the most dangerous developments out there. The belief that speech is violence. Now, because then that means that you would treat it in a completely different way. On the other hand, and I was just making notes about this before, you know, talking to you today, you know, speech obviously is not violence, but speech can lead to violence. So how do you draw those distinctions?
Well, it's one of these things where when I go on campus and I hear this argument that speech is violence, I have to point out that this isn't a new idea because people are like, oh, I've just discovered that our commitment to freedom of speech is a social construct. So therefore, we can just as easily say that speech is violence. But that also shows a poor knowledge of history because most of human history is speech and violence are considered more or less on a continuum or related, or in some cases, speech insults could be considered even worse because it's reputational and would require you ethically, as far as the norms of up until recently, to challenge someone to a duel or get their heads chopped off. So one thing, and what I'm getting to is the idea that we have this cultural decision to make a strong distinction between speech and violence. And it only exists as long as we believe in it, just like the whole intersubjective reality thing. But when it comes to most of the things that people want to prevent in terms of, I know you're saying that speech isn't violence, and I say right. Almost, you know, by definition, but, you know, can speech be violence? If you're talking about, you know, someone threatening, that's not protected speech. So a lot of the things that people point to as being like, well, what about this? I'm like, well, that's not protected speech because that's considered to cross a line and starts to look a lot more like action. Like threats of physical harm are not protected. Harassment, sexual harassment and racial harassment is not protected. That's, you know, that's a pattern of behavior that's severe, persistent and pervasive, that's discriminatory. But it is something that, particularly in the current environment, is a norm that actually can be met. So a lot of the stuff that people are really concerned about, what they don't realize is it's already not protected. And the reason why we're so concerned about this idea that speech is violence is that if students start believing it, it can lead to a unavoidable cycle of violence. So after the Milo riots in 2017, which were much more violent
tell me what the Milo riots were.
So Milo Yiannopoulos was supposed to speak at UC Berkeley. Now, Milo is deservedly someone who was not taken very seriously. He's a bomb thrower. He was always trying to provoke. He was always trying to, I mean, I think his tour was literally called the Triggered Tour or something like that.
Yeah.
He spoke at Berkeley, and there was a big protest to prevent him from speaking. So they actually canceled his speech. And sometimes this gets pointed out as like, yeah, you know, absolutely damn straight. That's, you know, glad we got rid of him. But the people who were actually hurt during the riots were in many cases student reporters, people who were just there to see what on earth was going on. And they say that there was about, you know, $600,000, maybe $500,000 of damage. But from watching the videos, it actually looks way worse than that. Now, the more disturbing thing, well, the riots themselves were actually quite disturbing. But the was the response of students and watch and UC Berkeley, the home of the free speech movement, had an issue that had all of the defenses of why, you know, reacting violently to Milo was okay. Several of them really insisting that there wasn't just offsite people. They were actually very proudly insisting that there were students there as well. Almost all of them going in the vein of his speech was violent, so therefore violent response it was appropriate. Now, the problem here is that if you believe speech is violence and you respond violently, then the other side gets to defend themselves violently. And also, by the way, if you believe that something that really offends you is violence, then there's nothing stopping anyone else from saying that. So the conservatives can now then believe that speech that offends them is violent. And it just leads to this spiral downward of violence, which honestly, like if you told me the political situation we are currently in 10 years ago, I would have said you were catastrophizing.
It's gotten much worse. Yeah.
And it's gotten so much worse. And so you really have to be defending vociferously the idea. It's like, listen, potent argument is actually part and parcel of democracy. It's part and parcel of politics. And it is does come with this decision that we will now settle what we once settled on the field of battle through argument and discussion. So of course it's gonna sting and it's gonna be difficult sometimes. But if you go back to the old idea of, you know, speech needs to be met with violence, that is a downward spiral that we can't afford right now.
The other development, of course, is identity politics and the implications for speech. You know what I'm talking about here, where often it seems less important what is said than who is saying it. And this is part of the debate over some of the critical race theory, that the identity of the speaker is as important or more important than the content of the speech. And you will see this all the time. And on social media debates that rather than deal with the substance of arguments, it's like, well, you know, you should shut up about this because you are a white male, or your identity, you know, somehow discredits your argument. So talk to me about that a little bit, because this again seems to have been really internalized, not just on campus, but in this larger culture as well.
Yeah. Well, my word for what we've constructed on campus, rather than using our best and brightest to figure out solutions to the world's problems, and there are people there, of course, who do that too. But we've also created this thing called what I call the perfect rhetorical fortress. For conservatives, I call it the efficient rhetorical fortress, which is essentially conservatives have figured out, you know, that they can sort of let themselves off the hook from listening to journalists, experts, or any liberals, which is a pretty efficient way to screen most people you should be listening to out. But the perfect rhetorical fortress is something that could only be produced by academics thinking about this for a very long time, because it's just layer after layer after layer, usually of repurposed ad hominem arguments, that ad hominem meaning that it's about the person, not about the argument, that allow you to sort of let yourself off the hook. But it's always optional, by the way. You never have to dismiss someone, for example, for being a conservative, which I called like the very first level of the perfect rhetorical fortress, because that was certainly around when I was in law school back in 97. But then the next level is identity. And if you like somebody, the fact that they're white and agrees with you, it's like, okay, I don't have to dismiss them. But if you dislike somebody and they are actually, say, like an African-American male like John McWhorter, you can then say, well, that person is expressing white supremacy, an argument that has been made against John McWhorter very recently. So it's this system of never actually getting to the substance of the argument people are making, because we've created all these different ways to never get there. And if you want to not listen to something, which is a very normal human impulse, we now have all these academic reasons to let you off the hook from listening to them, or for that matter, but you never have to use them. If someone is saying something you like, you know, then you don't have to use it against them. So it's this very unproductive way of arguing that gets us less than nowhere.
Well, and I think we see this all the time, is that so much of the political rhetoric is no longer designed to persuade anyone. It's because you're not actually trying to reason with someone. You're trying to use your arguments as a cudgel to beat the other person or to discredit the other person. And the ad hominem argumentation seems to have become, I'm not even sure that the vast majority of people understand that ad hominem argumentation is a rhetorical flaw, that it's a fallacy, that you're not supposed to do it, because it's become so complete. So I'm really interested in getting your take on this new university, the University of Austin, which was announced with great fanfare, lots of very, very high profile academics, including people you've been closely associated with. Mm-hmm. It's of course not a university at this point. It's kind of a website, but when people are, you know, but it is designed to be a counter to this culture of intolerance. So your thoughts about it.
My feeling is that even if the only problem that higher ed was currently facing was that it's too expensive and too bureaucratized, that would be reason enough to start doing serious experimentation with other models. And I think that we need experimentation, even just because things get stale over time in both K through 12 and higher ed. We need new models. We shouldn't, I mean, K through 12, you know, the argument is that we're still essentially educating kids like we did in the 19th century, which is, you know, largely accurate. So I believe in experimentation, but one of the things that was kind of amazing was after years of hearing from people who want to defend the incredibly wealthy, incredibly powerful, incredibly influential institution of American higher education, but somehow think of themselves as rebels, that if you don't like it, start your own university. And then Pano Canellis and Joe Lonsdale, started this, and several others started. Barry Weiss helped with the early stages, started their own, brand new university with an extra clear commitment to freedom of speech and academic freedom, and it got treated like with complete derision, even by people who I thought would support it. Is it necessarily going to work out well? I have no idea. Am I happy that people are trying this? Absolutely. I think
there's a long history of people going and forming their own institutions. I mean, the University of Chicago was formed with a specific intention with a specific kind of education. So this is not
Johns Hopkins
in the history of Johns Hopkins would be a perfect example of all of this. So speaking of the University of Chicago, the Chancellor Robert Zimmer was on the advisory board, which is just obviously has no actual response. It's an advisory board. And then he resigned almost immediately, saying that the new university, these are his words, made a number of statements about higher education in general, largely quite critical, that diverged very significantly from my own views. Now, he doesn't go into any depth about it, but he seems to be saying that some of the comments that were made about how higher education is just been completely destroyed or is no longer interested in the search for truth, that this was hyperbole or this was unfair. So there is some rockiness. Initially, but you'd expect that as well, I think. So,
and to be expected, and and it's people shouldn't confuse the idea of wishing something well to the idea that a confidence that will actually work out. But I mean, I've had to deal with, and getting back to the cost aspect of it, schools saying with a straight face that we charge $70,000 a year, all things included. But that only covers, and this is what you hear all the time, only half the cost of educating a single student. And I'm like, if you're really trying to tell me with a straight face that it costs $140,000 to educate a single student for a single year, well, one, I think that sounds kind of nuts. But two, given the fact that some of the studies that have been done of impact on critical thinking skills from higher ed, it's like, well, it doesn't sound like we're getting our money's worth. So we need to be experimenting in this space.
Well, again, don't get me started on the cost of higher education or the way the higher education generally treats undergraduate students or undergraduate teaching. That's a whole different issue. But one of the things that I learned over the years writing about higher education and wondering why there was not more market pushback against the ignoring of undergraduate students or the lousy quality of the curriculum or this kind of intellectual intolerance that we've been talking about is because for most Americans, higher education is kind of just the punching the ticket, isn't it? I mean, it's basically the credential and the most for the people who are writing out the checks, the most important thing is checking that box, punching that ticket, getting that credential and all the doors that it opens. And therefore, up until very recently, there has been an indifference or a complacency about what's actually going on inside the institution.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I think is also going on here that I'm glad that Batya Unger Sargon has shined a light on in journalism is that one of the reasons why you hear a lot about identity on campus, but a lot less about class I think at least in part is a pragmatic kind of decision that when the working class kids show up on campus, they tend to be they tend to be more skeptical of what the kids from upper class backgrounds do, or more skeptical of authority kind of in general. And increasingly decreasingly working class kids are showing up at some of these elite schools. And I think that a lot of what we see is a culture war. A lot of it is actually much more about economic class.
Are there ideas that have no place in higher education? And I'm asking that with intentionally provocative, because, you know, you and I would agree that there should be a wide latitude, but at the edges, mm-hmm. is there something that is beyond the pale where even you would say, okay, there's no place for professors who have, you know, who express these views?
Sure. Well, I mean, the absolute ideal is that we could remember this idea of scholarly detachment, that essentially you should be able to enter a mental space where you can do a counterfactual to any scenario you're faced with, that you can play devil's advocate on that, not because that theorizing is right, but because it's productive to making you think deeper about what history looks like, making you think deeper about human psychology. So in a truly healthy academic environment, we'd be able to talk about the range of things we could talk about would be much expanded, and the process of really interrogating everything from every possible angle would be much more normal. Do I think that like a professor who wants to be a professor of geophysics who thinks the world is flat, of course, that's going to be inconsistent. But I do want to say one thing about that is I get these kind of questions an awful lot about someone, you know, who has horrible opinions in their daily life. Is that we've been getting away from, is that there's nothing about having horrible opinions on a topic that means you're necessarily a bad teacher.
Right.
And the other way around, there's nothing about having all the good beliefs that makes you a good one. In fact, if you're really that doctrinaire, you might not even be that creative of a thinker. You may actually be extremely conformist. And I use conformist intentionally, because I do think that if you look at the whole process of everything from on campus, from the who gets accepted to undergrad, to the bias related incident programs, to the process of applying for jobs to be a professor, which now actually require diversity inclusion statements at all the schools in UC, and then even getting to tenure, there's so many different checks on your own conformity that I think it's Megan McArdle talks about the whole process being something designed to exclude true nonconformists. So I think that
and so much of it's done under the banner of diversity, although ideologically it becomes less and less diverse over time.
Absolutely, and it has. This is one of the amazing things about working with Jonathan Haidt on Coddling, was that I knew that there was low viewpoint diversity at some of these schools, but I was still in the model that thinking that it was more like 3-1 at most schools, liberal to conservative. But it's got so much worse, and it really accelerated in the late 90s. And that's one of the reasons why when people start talking about the diversity and inclusion statements that a lot of the schools in California are now requiring, which, by the way, if I'm understanding some of these correctly, the first step in that is it goes to human resources, not to someone who's academically inclined. They let the same administrators I've been warning about to decide it first before it even makes it into the acceptance bio, which is completely nuts. But I've said this, that essentially the idea that someone could have looked at the crop of professors as they currently exist and say, you know what, there's just not enough conformity among this cohort. We've got to clamp down on that is distressing.
So you talked before about the sort of the cycle of polarization, and a lot of what we're seeing is not in colleges or universities; it's in general society or K-12 education. But I am amazed by this explosion of banned books, including attempts to ban Fences, The Handmaid's Tale. I don't know when we became so afraid of books. It seemed like a cliche, banning and burning books. But apparently this is not just our imagination. And as you might have pointed out, Michelle Goldberg has written about this. The American Library Association tracks a list of books subject to challenges, and they're up 60% this year.
Oh, no.
In one year, the challenges to
I'm surprised
books.
It's that low.
I mean, Michelle Goldberg quotes a library official saying, you know, there's always been a steady, hum of censorship and the reasons have shifted over time, but I've never seen the number of challenges we've seen this year. So going back to your, reaction, I wonder where we're going here, that everybody seems to be putting up more walls, becoming more extreme, saying, we are going to ban your books. I mean, where does this lead in this sort of vortex cycle that you describe?
I'm afraid it's going to get worse before it gets better. I've been saying that since Coddling came out. We had a fairly rosy end to Coddling the American Mind, where we talked about things that could change. And I don't think John and I actually felt that things were going to be fine relatively soon. But we wanted to be like not so pessimistic.
You always want to end your book on a positive note.
and also, you know, have people encouraged to actually go out and do things rather than just think all is lost. But I think that things are probably going to keep getting worse for quite some time. John's working on a book called something about the Tower of Babel. And he thinks that this might be like the one sort of relatively calm year before a completely nuts decade. And I hope that's wrong. I remember, I was born in 74 and I live in DC and I was used to, for example, the crime rate going up almost every year. And I'd never actually experienced until I was in college it going down. And I was like, wow. And then, of course, that trend continued and kind of came. We still don't entirely know why that happened, why it went down, or for that matter, why it went up so much is also an interesting academic debate. And my hope is that maybe something like that happens in the culture war at some point, that essentially we've all been all of the existing simmering contempt for each other has all been put on steroids, partially due to social media. And, certainly the election of Trump sent all of those trends into free fall or spiraling out or whatever metaphor you want to use. Maybe things, I don't even think I can say that with a straight face. I think things are going to get worse for quite some time.
I completely agree with you. And the only possible, maybe things will get better is pure exhaustion. Is that people just become exhausted by, but,
or alien.
You would like to think that, as things become more extreme, people go, whoa, okay, it's gotten out of hand. We need to dial it back. We need to back off. I'm not seeing that at all. In fact, as things become more extreme, all of the incentives are to push it harder and harder and harder, because that's really where the incentive structure of media is these days. Greg, thank you so much. Greg Lukianoff, who's the president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, is an outstanding, irreplaceable organization, a co-author of The Coddling of the American Mind. You really should check out the database, which is really fascinating, all the different things that people are upset about, outraged about, offended about, and how it breaks down between the right and the left. We are facing this pincer movement. Greg, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Charlie.
And thank you all for listening to this weekend's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.